investors for fraud and forgery. This caused a panic amongst American investors because the huge volume of stocks sold at London caused the prices in the ticker tapes in America to be hours late. This widespread panic caused financial experts to advise the people to get out of the market. On October 29th of that same year, almost 16 million shares of stocks were traded, but some of them had no buyers at any price. The stock market lost more than $30 billion in just 2 days. It was the biggest stock market crash ever experienced in the USA. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. When the market finally closed, 9,212,800 shares had been sold. The Times index of 25 industrials fell from 367.42 to 318.29. The whole list showed alarming losses, and margin calls were on their way to those speculators who had not already sold out. This was real panic. It was what banks had prevented on Thursday, had slowed on Monday. Now they were helpless. Reportedly, they were trying to force their associated corporations to toss their buying power into the whirlpool, but they were getting no results. Albert Conway, New York State Superintendent of Insurance, took the dubious step of urging the companies under his jurisdiction to buy common stocks. If they did so, their buying was insufficient to halt the rout. Jonathan Leonard, reporter.
After the crash. For several years after Black Tuesday, people still felt the effects. Consumer spending drastically declined, which caused industrial production to go down as well, and this resulted in the laying off of hundreds of thousands of workers. By 1933, the Great Depression was at its peak. Almost 15 million Americans were unemployed, and almost half of the country's banking institutions had permanently closed shop. It was a very dark time in America. Hundreds of people showed up at bread lines and soup kitchens in the once wealthy cities. Ironically, farmers in the rural areas could not even afford to harvest their crops, which meant they had to let all that good food rot in their fields while millions of people were starving. This also had a huge effect on the social makeup of the United States, in particular the role of women. Men primarily occupied many of the major industries, and since these were the first to go, it often fell to the women to pick up the slack. This took a number of forms. Although there were some women in white-collar jobs who experienced fewer layoffs, most did their best to try and find a way to make enough money just to get by. In rural areas, and even in bigger cities, women would often grow their own vegetable and small gardens in order to supplement the cost of food. A whole culture of thriftiness, in sharp contrast to the luxurious spending spree culture of the 1920s, began to evolve. Learning how to get by with minimal resources, fixing clothes, reusing items, and repurposing things that would normally be thrown away became the staple. Many married women also joined the labor force in positions that were normally held by men, a trend that would continue and become vital and indispensable with the coming of the next world war. Most countries began to recover around 1933, and fortunately things started to change for the better when Franklin Delano Roosevelt took his oath as the President of the United States. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, it was a time of terrible suffering. The contradictions were so obvious that it didn't take a very bright person to realize something was terribly wrong. Have you ever seen a child with rickets, shaking as with palsy? No proteins, no milk, and the companies pouring milk into gutters. People with nothing to wear, and they were plowing up the cotton. People with nothing to eat, and they killed the pigs. If that wasn't the craziest system in the world, could you imagine anything more idiotic? This was just insane. And people blamed themselves, not the system. They felt that they had been at fault. If we hadn't bought that old radio, if we hadn't bought that old second-hand car. Among the things that horrified me were the preachers, the fundamentalists. They would tell the people they suffered because of their sins. And the people believed it. God was punishing them. Their children were starving because of their sins. People who were independent, who thought they were masters and mistresses of their lives,
were all of a sudden dependent on others, relatives, or relief. People of pride went into shock and sanatoriums. My mother was one. Virginia Durr.
A ray of hope. Immediately after taking his oath of office, Franklin D. Roosevelt started working on healing the U.S. economy. First, he announced a four-day bank holiday that would force all the banks to temporarily close so that Congress would have enough time to pass legislation that would help them recover. During this time, the United States had no idea that it was in for a big dose of government intervention. FDR was by far one of the greatest presidents that the nation had ever had. He was elected president four times and served three of his terms. To top it off, he was able to get the nation through the Depression and World War II while being confined to a wheelchair. He is most famous, however, for his economic solution to the Great Depression, which became known as the New Deal. FDR's New Deal was essentially made up of three major components: direct relief, economic recovery, and financial reform. Relief was very much needed for the American people at this time because a lot of them were living in poverty and in need of some type of assistance. About one-third of the United States population had been hit hard by the Depression and needed some immediate relief. FDR decided to expand upon the FERA work relief program that had been enacted by ex-President Hoover, and he also added a couple of other programs. Among these was the Civil Conservation Corps, CCC, which sent out over 250,000 young men to camp to work on reforestation and conservation projects. This program removed a lot of extra workers from the cities and provided a healthy arrangement for young men to make money for their families. Another important program was the Works Progress Administration, WPA, which gave work to over 8 million workers in construction, arts, theater, and other literary projects. The Social Security Act and unemployment insurance were also added to the palette. This was created as a way to try and combat the vast amount of poverty that had spread to senior citizens across the nation. Both of these acts have managed to withstand the test of time and remain important even today. Other programs, such as the RA and the FSA, were created to provide relief to individuals in the more rural areas of America as well. The next component was that of economic recovery. Recovery had the goal of getting the economy back to how it was prior to the Great Depression. It would involve the process of pump priming, which is deficit spending and making efforts to up the price of farm goods that were entirely too low. FDR also sought to increase foreign trade. Basically, economic reform meant trying to stimulate the buying and selling of goods again. One of the most important aspects of this was that of the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA. The TVA was created in order to build dams in the Tennessee River Valley area. Dams are an inexpensive method of achieving hydroelectric power and provided very stable irrigation for the area. The TVA was the first public competition among private power industries. The third and final component of the New Deal was that of reform. Reform seemed to be needed to ensure that a crisis like this would never happen again. The market seemed to be unstable, and the government felt that it needed to intervene in order to better stabilize the economy. FDR created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation to provide security and protection for bank depositors. He created the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, to serve as a guard dog for the stock market and thus prevent similar abuses that led to the 1929 stock market crash that caused the Great Depression. These programs primarily took the form of new industrial projects and was the first step in bringing the federal government into a more active economic role in the country. Many of the projects FDR spearheaded included new infrastructure, and in particular the development of roads and bridges, but also specific construction projects. In fact, one fun fact is that the Timberline Lodge, which is located on the south face of Mount Hood, was one of FDR's ideas. He looked on the Great Depression as a terrible failure on behalf of the government to help its citizens, but also realized it was an opportunity to get the United States back on track with building projects that would increase its economic growth and give people, most importantly, a sense of hope. The Timberline Lodge, in this case,
was one such example. With the support of local workers, it would become a shining beacon of FDR's New Deal politics. But there were a number of drastic actions taken as well. Probably the biggest and most controversial move that FDR made was taking the U.S. economy off the gold standard and making it illegal for ordinary citizens to own gold. Executive Order 6102 forbids the hoarding of gold in any of its forms in the continental United States. The reasoning for this EO was it would help remove the constraint preventing the Federal Reserve from increasing the supply of money in circulation. Fun fact. Executive Order 6102 is the reason why the 1933 gold double eagle coin is such a rarity today. Almost all of the known specimens of this rare coin were smelted back down into bars during the Great Depression. So finding one in good condition now is almost like winning the jackpot in the lottery. In fact, one 1933 gold double eagle in excellent condition was sold at a 2002 Sotheby's auction for a whopping $7.6 million. The unexpected benefit of World War II. When the United States eventually got dragged into World War II, the government started spending huge amounts of money on militarization. This sudden financial windfall rejuvenated the American steel industries and weapons manufacturers. After years of unemployment, U.S. citizens finally had jobs. This claim is quite controversial, as many historians disagree with the claim that World War II ended the Great Depression. Instead, they believe that the war just masked it until it eventually fizzled out in 1946. Nevertheless, it was clear that the economy did experience a revitalization at the outset of the war, in part because a number of the old antiquated industries that had been shut down during the Depression, such as steel mills and other construction markets, fired back up again in order to supply soldiers with the needed equipment and armaments. As we've seen, this was also a time when the gender normative division of labor was being breached, and more women were entering the workforce. With the U.S. and its connection to the war, this meant that many men ended up having to leave those jobs that were then filled by women. At this time, the unemployment rate was well below 10%. Something would have seemed unprecedented nearly a decade before. Misconceptions. The Great Depression was the country's first depression. While the Great Depression was certainly the longest economic depression the country had seen, it was not the first. In fact, prior to the Great Depression of the 1930s, there was a major worldwide economic depression beginning in 1873 and ending in approximately 1879 that was then also known as the Great Depression. This period of time is now referred to as the Long Depression. The Lusitania was not solely a passenger ship. Some historians will attribute the start of U.S. engagement in World War I with the sinking of the Lusitania, a passenger ship, but that's not entirely true. While the Lusitania did carry passengers, it was also carrying munitions, thus turning the passenger ship into an instrument of war. The Germans even placed prominent advertisements warning Americans that the war zones included British waters. Later, when Wilson presented his reasons to go to war to Congress, he cited Germany's broken promise on unrestricted warfare, but this was actually referring to the German violation of the Sussex Pledge, which required that Germany cease fire on ships carrying civilians. Can you believe this actually happened? Prohibitionists held strong to their beliefs and also thought that those that did not comply with prohibition should be punished in some fashion. Which of the following was not a suggested punishment? A. Lawbreakers should be tattooed. B. They should be forbidden to marry. C. They should be re-educated. D. They should be exiled. Answer. C. Some proponents of prohibition believe that non-compliant persons should be exiled, branded, tattooed, or even sterilized, and lawmakers should be forbidden to attend church or marry. Although public education and pamphlets about the evils of alcohol were prevalent at the time, re-education was not considered a potential form of punishment. What was Al Capone ultimately charged with? A. Racketeering. B. Organized crime. C. Assault. D. Tax invasion. Al Capone was never indicted for his efforts in organized crime. Although he ran bootlegging, prostitution, and gambling operations in Chicago, he was convicted of tax evasion and served only 6 years in prison. If the choice were yours, during the Great Depression, would you have provided food and monetary welfare or provided jobs? President FDR did both. He did enact some welfare programs, but quickly turned to developing work programs to curb unemployment. These public work programs brought the unemployment rate down from 25% to less than 10% by World War II. History has its eyes on us today. The long-term impacts of the New Deal programs, and the WPA in particular, are still felt today. For example, the WPA was responsible for expanding commercial aviation with the construction of about 600 airports. Library budgets had been cut nationwide, and WPA library projects revived communities and repaired close to 30 million books, as well as established extension programs that brought library services to remote areas by unconventional means, such as boat and horse, resembling the modern bookmobile. Chapter 6. The Second World War. Unfortunately for the world, the Great War was not the war to end all wars. Another, bloodier conflict erupted a mere 20 years later. The defeated Germany felt oppressed by the terms imposed by Woodrow Wilson and, with a resurgent leader, went on the offense again. World War II. Once again, America was interested in a neutral position. A new addition to this war was the East Asian power of Japan. The Japanese, after having opened up to the West, mostly through American persuasion, in the early part of the century, wanted an empire of their own. Their imperial ventures in East Asia and the Pacific eventually led to inevitable conflict with America. Japan also happened to be allied with Germany, which put it on the opposite side of traditional American allies France and Britain. The Japanese were involved in World War I, but the empire took on more importance in this conflict. Britain had pleaded with America to join the war, but America was not interested in committing more troops to another mechanized, highly efficient meat grinder. The official stance was neutrality and avoiding foreign entanglements. America signed a deal with Britain called the Destroyers for Bases Agreement, which saw America supporting Britain in the war indirectly. The United States transferred 50 destroyers to the British Navy, and America was given rights to build and maintain bases in several territories claimed by the British Empire. A further agreement, named Lend-Lease, was a program by the United States to send food, oil, and materials, including weaponry, to Britain, France, China, and others in exchange for leasing lands to build bases. This was not a direct involvement of the United States in the war, but it significantly helped the Allied powers against their enemies as they could rely on the natural resource reserves of the U.S. and even sometimes armaments from the massive American industrial base. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. Dear Mother and Dad, as you may have already learned from the official telegram, I have been slightly wounded. A piece of shrapnel hit my right thigh between the knee and the hip, but did not break the leg. Another piece hit my back on the left side, but didn't go in very far. Both have been removed. I am now sewed up, no bones were broken, and I feel okay. They were really very slight wounds, nothing at all to worry about. I should be up and walking around shortly, and enjoying these white sheets and nice beds. I'm in a general hospital. It is luxurious, to say the least. Don't worry. Love, Paul. Letter from Paul Fussell to his parents. The avoidance of entanglement in foreign wars, however, could not last forever. The same sentiment of non-involvement that had been espoused by citizens prior to the First World War was again asserted, but this time there was also a sense of pride in the fact that they had managed to win that war and pull themselves out of the Depression. Also, the United States was now a global empire with global interest, and this necessitated their eventual role in what would follow. The Imperial Japanese expansion in the Pacific came to a head with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii on December 7, 1941. The attack, sometimes known as Operation Z, was a surprise military attack on the naval base in Hawaii. Taken completely off guard, there was little that the American soldiers could do, and nearly 2,400 were killed in what FDR would later say in his famous speech was a day which will live in infamy. Some theorists have argued that the government knew about the attack but did not stop it in order to galvanize the public into joining the war on behalf of the Allies. This is certainly corroborated by the fact that at the time many American citizens did not want to get involved, and there was a feeling both in the societal and political realms that this time the U.S. should stay out. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, any sort of public reservation about joining the war seemed to vanish. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. When this new wave of fighters attacked, we were ordered to run and take shelter. Most of us ran to our nearest steel hangar. This bomb attack made us aware that the hangar was not a safe place to be. Several of us ran north to an abandoned officers' club and hid under it until it was too machine-gunned. I managed to crawl out and took off my white uniform because I was told that men in whites were targets. I then climbed under a large thorny bush. For some reason, I felt much safer at this point than I had during the entire attack. Gordon Jones, who was stationed at Kaneohe at Pearl Harbor. The Japanese officially declared war on the United States, and the United States declared war on the Japanese the very next day. New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the Netherlands also declared war on Japan. Almost simultaneously, Japan made coordinated attacks on other American territories in the Pacific, namely Guam, the Philippines, and Wake Island. The war escalated quickly. Countries were declaring war on each other seemingly daily in December of 1941. 4 days after Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States, and America reciprocated. America was now at war on two fronts. In the Pacific theater, Americans suffered a series of losses, but finally made some headway with a major victory in the Battle of Midway. The U.S. made some advancements in their code-breaking ability and were able to intercept key details that allowed the U.S. to cut off potential attacks. The 3-day battle resulted in major losses for the Japanese in terms of resources, and historians say that there was no way they could rebound. The Guadalcanal campaign shortly followed the Battle of Midway. Guadalcanal was a series of battles in the Pacific and marked the first offensive campaign by Allied forces. The Allied forces came out again victorious, and the two losses sustained by Japan was decidedly a major turning point in the Pacific War. The United States had a role in the North African theater as well. The U.S., along with other Allied forces, conquered the North Africa region after a series of battles that ended with the Battle of Tunisia, led by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who later became president. Before the United States joined the war, a battle in the skies took place, which was a major turning point in the European theater. German and British air forces fought for months, while the Germans simultaneously engaged in night attacks known as the Blitz. Ultimately, the Germans lost and were unable to force Britain's surrender. This dramatically changed the opinions of Americans who thought Britain would not survive. Then, the Americans joined the fray after the events at Pearl Harbor, and the major world powers had taken their places. Another huge turning point in the European theater took place between June and August of 1944. The Battle of Normandy was a massive attack on German forces in Western Europe and resulted in Allied forces liberating most of the region from German control. The first day of this battle was known as D-Day, and the battle commenced June 6, 1944. American, British, and Canadian forces launched this amphibious assault, and it's the largest attack of its kind in military history. Historians mark this battle as the beginning of the end for the Germans, but the war wasn't over. American and Allied forces were not always so fortunate. One notable loss was the failure of a massive airborne attack known as Operation Market Garden. Allied forces were aiming to cross the Rhine River, which would have been a major win for them. However, primarily due to weather conditions, paratroopers were scattered to the winds and were unsuccessful in this campaign. Germans would retain control of that region until the end of the war in Europe. The last offensive attack on Allied troops was the Battle of the Bulge, so called because the German forces created a bulge in surrounding forces. The attack was a complete surprise, and the United States was greatly outnumbered at the onset and suffered heavy losses. Ultimately, it was an Allied victory, but it came at a great cost. The Battle of the Bulge was responsible for the most American casualties of any one battle. The Allied forces were hit hard enough that the end of the war was pushed back due to fatigue and supply losses. The Germans were unable to recover from their losses in both troops and resources. The war saw a plethora of new technologies instituted, with the Germans having an early advantage in aircraft and encryption. The latter was a major motivator for the development of the computer, which would come to shape the world. A superweapon was born as well. Many German scientists fleeing Nazi persecution came to the United States. Some of these scientists then worked on a top-secret project known as the Manhattan Project. The fruit of this project was the atomic bomb. While never used against Germany, the bomb was used against Japan. The president's authorization of the use of the weapon is still controversial today, but history does not change. Two successful nuclear attacks against Japan forced the surrender of the Imperial Japanese military in 1945, and the United States emerged as the sole superpower. While Germany, the USSR, and Japan had all committed research to the atomic bomb, after the war in 1946, only the United States had the technology. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. But then the singing and the cries grew weaker. My classmates were dying one by one. That made me very frightened. I struggled to free myself from the broken fragments and looked around. I thought that gas tanks had exploded. Through a hole in the roof, I could see clouds swirling in a cone. Some were black. Some were pink. There were fires in the middle of the clouds. I checked my body. Three upper teeth were chipped off. Perhaps a roof tile had hit me. My left arm was pierced by a piece of wood that stuck in my flesh like an arrow. Unable to pull it out, I tied a tourniquet around my upper arm to staunch the flow of blood. I had no other injuries, but I did not run away. We were taught that it was cowardly to desert one's classmates. So I crawled about the rubble calling, "Is there anyone alive?" Then I saw an arm shifting under planks of wood. Ota, my friend, was moving, but I could see that his back was broken, and I had to pull him up into the clear. Ota was looking at me with his left eye. His right eyeball was hanging from his face. I think he said something, but I could not make it out. Pieces of nails were stuck on his lips. He took a student handbook from his pocket. I asked, "Do you want me to give this to your mother?" Ota nodded. A moment later, he died. By now, the school was engulfed in flames. I started to walk away, and then I looked back. Ota was staring at me with his one good eye. I can still see that eye in the dark. Yoshitaka Kawamoto.
Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union lay in ruins. The United States, on the other hand, was, just like in the last European war, mostly unscathed except for the loss of citizens who had died in the war. Its infrastructure was intact, and the following years witnessed the final steps of the American Republic becoming a global force. The new superweapon, the atomic bomb, was not America's alone for long. In 1949, the Soviet Union, promoting communism, successfully tested its own nuclear weapon. Women in World War II. The role of women at home and in the military changed dramatically with World War II. With so many men serving in the military, there was a huge gap in the workforce, and women quickly took up jobs traditionally held by men in factories. One in four married women was working outside the home, although they still earned significantly less than their male counterparts. Women also served in the military and in the Women's Army Corps. These women served at home and in every theater of the war in non-combatant roles. There were similar units in the Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines. One particularly interesting aspect of women's history in the war was the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, also known as WASPs. These women flew military aircraft from factories to bases and participated in simulations. Their work was invaluable, and some women even lost their lives,
but the group was not officially recognized as a military unit until 1977. In 2010, WASP received the Congressional Gold Medal. African Americans in World War II. Despite racial inequality and a history of oppression, tens of thousands of African Americans served in World War II as volunteers. Black men and women were allowed to serve, but were required to sleep in segregated barracks, eat at segregated mess halls, and serve in segregated units. Approximately 145,000 men served in the U.S. Air Force. One particularly famous unit was known as the Tuskegee Airmen, and they were legendary for their heroism and action during the war. Black women enlisted in the Women's Auxiliary Army Corps, but again were restricted to segregated units. These black women made up 10% of the WAAC. The war also made many African Americans raise questions and note similarities between how the Germans oppressed the Jews and how the whites in the South treated the blacks. Operation Paperclip. One major consequence of World War II was a buildup of technology. The warring powers spent great sums of money to counter each other's research. Germany did not go to war believing its technology was inferior to the Allies. In fact, the Blitzkrieg style of warfare, which handed the Germans quick victory, was made possible largely due to the Nazis' technological supremacy. Similar technological superiority had given the colonists of early America a significant advantage over the natives. Due to this superiority, the United States and the Soviet Union, even before the end of the war, prepared to take in Nazi scientists who may have had valuable information and research performed for the Third Reich. Operation Paperclip was such an initiative. The most prominent scientist to be recruited through the program was Wernher von Braun. Von Braun had helped Germany develop its V-2 rockets, which had rained terror upon Britain during the war. Instead of trying such scientists in courts or barring them from employment in the victorious Allied nations, the U.S. recruited them for the upcoming Cold War. The U.S. knew the USSR was the only other nation on Earth at the time capable of challenging the U.S. And for that reason, the U.S. embarked on a mission to recruit Nazi scientists before they could be captured or enticed by the Russians. Truman ordered that no scientists with Nazi ties be recruited, but that would have rendered ineligible most of the scientists they were targeting for recruitment. For that reason, many of the scientists with Nazi backgrounds were given false biographies to allow them entry into the United States. Von Braun helped bring the United States the rockets that would launch satellites and men into space during the space race. It was not just aerospace engineers that received offers, though. Chemists and physics were among the scientists included in the recruitment. Overall, the United States and the United Kingdom brought in 1,600 scientists from the end of World War II to the end of the Cold War. Internment camps. While at war with Japan, the United States was actually home to many hundreds of thousands of Japanese immigrants. These were everyday citizens who had come to America in order to find a new life, and many were business owners who had built themselves from the ground up. With the U.S. embroiled in a war with Japan, though, certain racial fears began to surface. Racism and violence preceded a general sentiment of suspicion surrounding Japanese immigrants, 62% of whom were actually United States citizens. This would eventually lead to the creation of internment camps for all Japanese citizens in the country through Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, which effectively allowed the military at home to exclude all Japanese citizens on the entire West Coast. Internment camps were very similar to the sort of POW camps that soldiers overseas would experience and were fenced off to prevent Japanese people from leaving. This came as a blow to American Japanese people who had cut ties with their homeland and who had been living in the United States, sometimes for generations. It was indicative of how scared the general population was of the Japanese threat. The irony was that the majority of people interned were men, women, and children who had never held a weapon in their lives. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. I remained in the security of my home on Terminal Island until the second day of February 1942. Then agents from the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the Federal Bureau of Investigation visited me in my home. I am imprisoned within the walls of the immigration station on Terminal Island. 2nd February 1942. During the early morning hours of 2nd February 1942, government agents from the FBI and the INS, Immigration Naturalization Service, quietly converge on Terminal Island and spread out fan-like into our fishing village for a mass arrest of alien Japanese. Fishermen are aroused from their sleep. The womenfolk cry out as unrest and alarm spread quietly throughout our community. At 6:30 a.m., Messrs. Tonai and Wada are forcibly carted off for detention within the four walls of the INS building on Terminal Island. Frantically, Miss Tonai pounds on the door of my house. She informs me of the FBI roundup and then is reluctant to return home. Commotion within my house increases as other wives and children converge at my place to seek comfort and solace. However, I feel that it is only a matter of time before I, too, am arrested and detained. Therefore, I advise my friends to leave, for I would be helpless to render any form of assistance. My mind weighs heavy with personal family matters that require immediate attention. To my wife, Takako, I give $200 for deposit to our bank account. Another $150 I split three ways and pass out for emergency funds. Other details race through my mind, and I am preoccupied with a miscellany of last-minute details. At 8:30 a.m., there's a knock on the door. Government agents have come for me. Toyojiro Suzuki.
Development of nuclear power. As war raged on two fronts for the United States, both in Europe and in the Indochina sphere with Japan, it was clear that this war would become a much longer, more drawn-out, costly war for everyone involved. In the final push into Normandy on D-Day, the Allies had effectively gained a foothold in Europe again and pushed back Hitler's armies. It was only a matter of time now before Germany would eventually accept surrender. However, the war in the Pacific was still going strong and was much harder to end. Part of the reason was that Japan was effectively isolated. On one side, it had the entire breadth of the Pacific Ocean, and on the other, a number of countries in between it and the next Allied superpower. An overland and terrestrial approach was deemed too expensive. The Manhattan Project was already underway in New Mexico. With brilliant minds like Oppenheimer on site, the scientists there had been experimenting with the power of nuclear fission in the form of atomic bombs. The first atomic bomb trial was held on July 16, 1945. The massive explosion that followed was enough to convince both the president and commanders that this was a weapon that could effectively end the war once and for all, avoiding protracted losses of life on both sides of the conflict. On August 6, a uranium gun-type bomb named Little Boy was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, leveling it in an explosion that vaporized thousands. Harry Truman, now president of the U.S., called for the surrender of Japan, and 3 days later, another bomb, Fat Man, was dropped on Nagasaki with similar consequences. The loss of life is estimated to be as high as 146,000 in Hiroshima and 80,000 in Nagasaki, and in the months that followed, a huge number of people became infected with radiation sickness. While the war had come to an end, the cost was felt most strongly by the Japanese people. The bombs had not been, like Pearl Harbor, a tactical or military target, but rather a civilian one, and the majority of those who died were everyday citizens. Today, the ethical implications of using a nuclear bomb are still debated, and questions are still raised as to whether the U.S. was justified in their actions. Currently, there is a war memorial in Hiroshima designated to foster peace in the hopes that nuclear war will never again be used as an incentive or solution in a world conflict. Cold War, Korea, and McCarthyism. The diametric difference between communism and capitalism, coupled with America not being the only power with nuclear technology, set off the Cold War. The fear of the spreading influence of communism forced the United States to attempt to contain the Soviet Union and its influence.
Communism was by no means a new idea. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels founded the ideal during the latter portion of the 19th century. The general idea behind communism rests on the belief that capitalism gives birth to competition. With communism, economic equality is achieved by eliminating people having private property. The entire idea is to give power to the working class. In order to preserve this way of life and enforce it, violence is often necessary. This is what makes it so dangerous. Although it sounds good in theory, when practiced, there can be negative consequences. The rich are brought down to be poorer, and the poor are brought up to be richer. People are not encouraged to do better for fear that it will get taken away. Freedoms are severely limited because the goal is to put everyone on the same level. It is the ultimate form of government control. When you truly think about it, it is obvious why the United States saw communism as a major threat to democracy. The paranoia reached a fever pitch in the 1950s when McCarthyism, named after the congressman who instigated accusations against alleged American communists, started. At the same time, the first proxy war between America and the USSR occurred. The United States practiced an official policy of containment against the USSR to stem its spread. In 1950, the Northern Communist forces attempted to take over the entire Korean Peninsula, which was under joint American and Soviet occupation following the partitioning of the Japanese Empire. This led to a three-year devastating war for Korea and is considered the first military conflict of the Cold War. After World War II, Japan's empire was dismantled, and the Soviets and Americans split control of Korea along the 38th parallel, with the Soviets occupying the northern half and the United States occupying the southern half. By 1950, two dictators ran either side of Korea, one communist, the other anti-communist. Both sides were looking to invade the other's territory. North Korea invaded the South, and eventually the war reached a stalemate. The armistice was signed nearly 2 years after the ceasefire. The nation is still divided by the border set up by this conflict, over six decades since the beginning of the war and still decades after the fall of the USSR. The last 2 years of the war was an attrition war that eventually drove enemy forces to the 38th parallel, where a demilitarized zone was set up between North and South. Today, it still exists and is a source of grief for many in the South who still have family in the North. The fear that communism could eventually take over the entire globe and extinguish the American way of life had some unexpected side effects. The political freedom and freedom of speech championed by Americans since the beginning of the nation, in one form or another, was hampered by the Red Scare or McCarthyism. During this era, 1950 to 1956, Congressman Joseph McCarthy accused many of being communist and implemented investigations, but he was not the only one. Thousands of Americans were accused of sympathizing with communism, and while the number sent to prison for espionage or other punishable crimes was relatively low, the thousands affected still lost jobs and faced social expulsion. Simply being accused or investigated could substantiate the removal from a position, and many faced being fired from their jobs due to such investigations. The feverish pursuit of suspected communist sympathizers showed signs of the suspension of innocent until proven guilty. While that did not hold up in court, it still meant people were unable to find employment afterward. One of the most notorious and well-known examples of this is the blacklist in Hollywood, where applicants were denied employment because it was suspected that they had communist sympathies. The entire populace did not support the movement, and even Truman, who was not particularly liberal, criticized the action, stating that, "In a free country, we punish men for the crimes they commit, but never for the opinions they have." Of course, to make an opinion a crime only requires an act of legislation, but there was no such law at the time. One of the effects of this Red Scare and the increasing paranoia supplied by McCarthyism was a reboot of the old Federal Bureau of Investigation. It suddenly became a focal point, involved in a number of investigations, and grew considerably during these years. Under the auspices of Edgar J. Hoover, who became the director of the FBI, whole task forces were sent out to question those with supposed communist affiliations. This led to thousands of people being interrogated. However, Hoover was adamant about not revealing his sources or informants, so often people had no way of controverting the evidence placed against them or even knowing who had accused them. This practice would eventually come to define the late 1950s, and McCarthy's name would become synonymous with paranoia, questioning loyalty, and poor reasoning, a legacy that he probably had no intention of leaving behind. With increased hostilities between Russia, the Cold War did not end quickly, but following World War II, neither side was prepared for an all-out conflict. Immediately following the Red Scare, the Soviet Union put its first satellite into space, and the United States responded with its space program. The possibility that communist ideology could beat Western capitalism and technology caused significant anxiety among the population, especially when it seemed whoever controlled space could quickly deliver nuclear weapons while rendering the other side's weapons obsolete. As with many aspects of American history, and indeed history in general, military dominance and security issues drove the space race. Bay of Pigs. The Bay of Pigs invasion was a failure by the Americans in the Cold War. In 1959, Fidel Castro overthrew Cuba's American-backed president, General Fulgencio Batista. Batista was originally president of Cuba in the 1940s and tried to run for president again in 1952. His defeat was imminent, so he staged a military coup before the election. The United States funded and supported this action. Batista's dictatorship is what prompted Castro's move. After this government overthrow, the United States was eager to remove Castro from power and restore an American-supported government. Castro developed close ties to the Soviet Union after the government overthrow. In April of 1961, the American government thought they had a solution. The CIA funded and trained a group of exiled Cubans with the intent of invading the country and seizing control. The exiles were quickly defeated, and while the CIA hoped to keep its involvement a secret, this was impossible given the size of the operation. Cuban Missile Crisis. Cuban-Soviet-American relations were teetering on the edge of conflict, and after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, President John F. Kennedy continued to make plans to overthrow the communist regime in an effort known as Operation Mongoose. While Kennedy formulated this plan, the Soviets made a secret plan with Castro to build Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba to deter any future invasion. With Cuba only 90 miles from Florida, this would put nuclear arms within reach of U.S. soil. The 13-day conflict was carried out through direct and indirect communication between the Soviets and the Americans and was the closest the two nations came to nuclear war. Events were also unfolding on television, creating a tense atmosphere for all parties as nuclear war could be imminent. The Soviets demanded that U.S. missiles in Turkey be removed as part of the agreement to cease missile-based construction in Cuba, but the U.S. insisted this not be a part of the public negotiations. The next day, Khrushchev publicly declared that Soviet missiles in Cuba would be dismantled and removed. Fun fact, the Korean War, although it managed to produce a division between North and South, was one war in which the United States never actually signed a peace treaty after the conclusion of hostilities. Although there is a peace treaty with the Democratic South, a peace treaty or ceasefire has never been signed with North Korea. Misconceptions. The atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki ended the U.S. war with Japan. While this was certainly a major part of Japan's surrender, the bombing actually coincided with a simultaneous invasion of Manchuria by the Soviets. The final push from two fronts was enough to force Japan to surrender, which was preceded by a heavy bombing campaign that killed over 250,000 people, more than Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. The U.S. did not make the Soviets back down in the Cuban Missile Crisis. There is a common misconception that America essentially made the Soviets back down, but in reality, the U.S. traded Jupiter missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis ended via trade, not force or intimidation. Can you believe this actually happened? Which was the first war that the United Nations participated in? A. World War II. B. Korean War. C. Cold War. D. World War I. Answer. The United Nations first participated in the Korean War. The UN was asked to aid South Korea, and 16 countries provided military support, while 41 supplied equipment or other aid. The House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, did not disband until 1975. A. True. B. False. Answer. True. The House Un-American Activities Committee, originally established in 1938, became a standing House committee in 1945. The ideological goals of the committee changed, as well as the committee name, in 1969. HUAC then became known as the House Internal Security Committee and fought against domestic terrorism. The committee was abolished in 1975 amid the climate of the Watergate scandal and the Vietnam War. History has its eyes on us today. The conflict in Korea originated from Japanese occupation during World War II. When Japan surrendered, Korea was split along the 38th parallel, with the northern half occupied by the Soviet Union and the southern half occupied by the United States. These two areas were occupied until 1948 as the two countries of the Republic of Korea, South Korea, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, which wanted a unified Korea under communist rule. North Korea invaded the South in 1950, starting a three-year war. The terms of the armistice signed in 1953 outlined the need for a demilitarized zone, DMZ. The DMZ is still in place and heavily guarded to this day. North Korea is still under communist rule and frequently makes threats of nuclear missile attacks. If the choice were yours, would you report friends and neighbors you suspect of having radical political opinions? The fact is, during what was known as the Second Red Scare, many people were accused of having communist leanings or opinions, leading to some people being blacklisted from future employment, particularly in Hollywood. The Smith Act of 1940 made it a criminal offense to knowingly or willfully advocate, abet, advise, or teach the desirability or propriety of overthrowing the government of the United States or of any state by force or violence, or for anyone to organize an association which teaches, advises, or encourages such an overthrow, or for anyone to become a member of or to affiliate with any such association. This became synonymous with communism, although there is not a direct correlation between a political party and a government overthrow.
Chapter 7. The Cold War and Pax Americana. The Space Race. On October 4, 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1 into orbit. It was the very first time in history such a feat had been accomplished, and it served as the spark that started the space race. A few months later, the Russians sent another satellite into orbit, Sputnik 2, and this time it carried a living payload, Laika the dog. This struck another blow to the ego of the United States. Not to be outdone by their Cold War rival, in 1961, then-President John F. Kennedy announced that the United States would be increasing funding for space exploration and made a hefty promise that before the decade's end, they would send a man to the moon. Sadly, JFK would not live to see the fruits of his labor. On November 22, 1963, an assassin's bullet took away the president's life. Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy's VP, would take over the office and continue his dream of sending a man to the moon. On October 1, 1958, the U.S. government formed the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, to replace the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, NACA, which then led to serious studies of how they could send people into outer space. In 1959, the Soviet space program seemingly got a leg up over its American counterpart by launching the Luna 2, the first space probe to actually land on the moon. Then, on April 1961, they successfully sent cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin into orbit and got him home safely. On May 5th of that same year, the Americans finally sent their own astronaut, Alan Shepard, into outer space. However,
Shepard did not orbit the Earth like Gagarin did.
Space race casualties. The space race, as flamboyant and entertaining as it was not without incident. A couple of serious setbacks on both sides of the space race almost halted their efforts. For instance, on the Soviet side, Sergei Korolev, the chief engineer of their space program, suddenly died and left a vacuum in their organization. It took years before the Soviet space program could find a suitable replacement and continue their research. To make matters worse, cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov died because the parachute of his Soyuz 1 capsule failed to deploy upon re-entry into the atmosphere. Reports said that he was crying in rage as he plummeted to his demise. On the other hand, a horrifying accident almost turned the U.S. public off the prospect of continuing with the space race entirely. Astronauts Virgil Gus Grissom, Roger Chaffee, and Ed White were conducting a launch pad test on the Apollo 1 when a fire suddenly broke out inside the spacecraft. All three men died. NASA, in respect of their deaths, decided to slow down the space exploration research so they could concentrate more on the safety and well-being of the crew. The culmination of the space race. On July 16, 1969, American astronauts Neil Armstrong, Edwin Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins launched from Cape Canaveral on board the Apollo 11 spacecraft. After 4 days, their landing craft successfully touched down on the surface of the moon, and Neil Armstrong became the first man to step on the moon. He said that it was one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. With this, the United States officially won the space race and actually fulfilled Kennedy's promise that the U.S. would send a man to the moon before the end of the 1960s. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Yes, the surface is fine and powdery. I can kick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers like powdered charcoal to the sole and sides of my boots. I only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine, sandy particles. Neil Armstrong.
The Apollo program also represented a shift in the American psyche. Suddenly it was possible to do anything, and this sense of national pride would resonate for decades to come. It was also one of the most expensive programs ever funded by the U.S., an estimated $20 billion. Today, with inflation taken into account, that would be equal to around $206 billion. The new Saturn-style engines were much larger than the kinds used in previous flights, and a huge amount of technological prowess went into the project. This, more than anything, is what the program really meant as a legacy for future space travel. It pushed the envelope in terms of what had, up until then, only ever been dreamed of. And the entire nation tuned in.